Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim. Join host Dan Melnick and Qasim Masood as they explore big ideas, limitless possibilities, and engage with visionaries, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who dare to dream big. Get inspired, motivated, and find practical tips for personal growth. Think big, dream bigger, and ignite your potential.
All right, welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim, and our guest today is Adam Sandman. So Adam, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, tell us where you live and what you do for a living.
Hi, everyone. My name's Adam Sandman, and I'm the founder and CEO of Inflectra. And Inflectra, we're a software company that helps companies improve the quality of their software delivery. And I founded the company 17 years ago and been growing it with my excellent team ever since. And we're based and headquartered in the Washington, D.C. area, where I'm calling from today. But we do have teams around the world in various geographies, pretty much in every continent, which is kind of exciting. And in fact, I was in Germany before Thanksgiving to meet some of our team members in Europe and attend some conferences there.
That's awesome. So how did you get the idea to start this business?
Well, Dan, the question is interesting because a lot of times you have a lot of ideas, but they come from periods in your life and then they sort of come when the time is right. So they sort of germinate. So what happened is I've been working in the software industry for, I guess, 10, 12 or so years before I started the company, working for consulting firms. And in those firms, we had to manage software development, manage software testing, manage all the different parts of the software lifecycle. And as a project manager slash system architect, I hated testing. And it's true, despite the fact that we do a lot of work with the software testing community, and I was in software testing conferences last week, I always found testing to be the worst part of software delivery. And even when we moved to agile methodologies, it was still probably the most painful part. And so the original genesis of the company was that was the most painful part for me and all my teammates. And then talking to other members of the company I work for, it was a common theme. And then we looked at tools in the industry that could meet the need. And we did find a couple. They were very expensive. They were old. They were hard to use. And they wouldn't license for a consulting firm. You had to buy it per client, various other reasons. And so I saw a gap in the market. But then I really kind of waited a bit because, you know, life happens. And then there was an acquisition in the industry. The competitors of that tool got bought, and there was a disruption. And at the same time in my life, I was ready from a personal standpoint to launch a company. I had young children at the time. They were a little bit older and were right. And so the market was primed. And so that's why I launched the company in 2006, right before the financial crisis, of course, which is always a fun time to start a business.
Makes sense. Like, as of today, can you just talk more about the business? Like, who is your customer and how are they using your business today?
Great. Yeah, our customers are typically, they're not exclusively, medium to large companies. So we don't focus much on the small and medium size, small size companies. Typically, medium to large companies that are focused on software development, software delivery of large, complex, mission-critical systems, particularly in industries where you can't make a mistake. So think of healthcare, medical devices, finance, banking, insurance, supply chain, aerospace, automotive, those types of industry where if you build software, whether that's a system that's a website you're using or it's a self-driving car, it's a medical device, it's a medical system that will do pharmacy delivery, all those kinds of systems. If they make a mistake, you know, people die, cars crash, planes won't take off, air traffic control systems go down, dot, dot, dot. Those are the types of client we're servicing. And our product really helps them do a much better job, hopefully, of managing the software delivery, development, testing, designing, ideation process from end to end for those kinds of industry. Because a lot of times these companies, they're using tools that weren't built for that critical of a system. In some cases, they're using, unfortunately, spreadsheets, Word documents, Google Sheets to manage all this, easy to get data lost. They might be using tools that were built for startups and, you know, a much less regulated industry and trying to make it all work. So we give them an integrated suite that guarantees that they will have a quality product at the end over multiple releases.
So in what stage would somebody use your product? Is it more of like if they're building out like a new system, or if they're adding features to their current system, like where would it be relevant for a company to come in and use you?
Great question. And it does depend a little bit on the company and their scale. So typically, we don't typically service a lot of startups with new, brand new ideas that about to hit the market. They would usually want a bit more scale before they use the product. The exception, I would say, at the beginning would be if you're a company that's coming up with a software product that you know is going to be highly regulated later. Imagine it was a startup that's going to work in biotechnology or aerospace, self-driving self-driving cars, or these new flying Uber taxis in the air, that kind of thing. Anytime you're dealing with a plan to go large later, you should start doing it right at the beginning. So I would say at the beginning, it's useful to get things done right. So that's definitely one use case. Another use case is you've had a product that you've got a proof of concept, you've got through the early stages, you've got funding, you're now starting to take this to the next stage where you need to develop a product that's going to be robust, not just an MVP. So the second phase would be going from an MVP to pre-production. That's another good phase where you might adopt our product, whereas before you'd gotten by with something that was less sophisticated. And then the third case would be you're in production, you're getting feedback from customers, your users, you're adding new features, and you want to add features without breaking what you already have. And that's a very hard process. Once you're live with the system, the room for error is less actually than when you're going live with the MVP sometimes, because you've got to keep what's working whilst adding functionality, like doing surgery whilst the patient is alive. And that so I think those are the three typical use cases. There are some other more specialist ones like cloud migrations, moving infrastructure, everything has to work on a new platform, replatforming, things like that. But generally speaking, it's when you're going to take something that's maybe not mission critical, make it mission critical, that it becomes imperative.
Makes sense. So in terms of client acquisition, like what has been the best channel and best strategy for you to scale and grow this business?
Yeah, that we've tried several different channels, which is like anything, you try inbound, outbound, channel sales. Inbound has generally worked well. So first thing, because we're selling a relatively sophisticated product that has industry use cases, it's not something you're going to buy and literally implement in a day or two. It may take a few weeks. There's a change management component. Someone's going to have to change how their team works. So if we were to email you and say it's free and you've never heard of us and you don't need this right now, you're going to not going to do anything. So generally cold outbound has not worked super well for us, just because it requires enough change at the client site that they have to be ready to buy. So inbound has been very successful. White paper based, webinar based, that high content consultative approach works well. Direct outbound not work so well. But on the other hand, channel partners is an area we're tapping more and more. That's helping a lot, because in the channel sales, you've got consulting partners who are already working with these clients day in, day out. They know the problems and they know what stage the client's at. So for us, being a smaller company, what we often will try and do is partner with boutique consulting firms or boutique service firms, or even maybe boutique incubators that are going to work with these clients and will bring them to us part of their offering. They will help the client, improve their testing or improve their project management, and they need tools to do that, and they recommend our tools. So they're able to provide services and change management and the product. So channel sales, particularly medium to small consulting firms, works well. And then as we get bigger, we crack into more of the GSI, the global system integrator markets, where we're probably a bit small. And if anyone's listening to this podcast about and looking about channel acquisition, it's important to have what I would call partner match, not partner mismatch. So if you're a small company, you're trying to partner with Deloitte, it's not going to be a good fit. They're too big. They won't have the attention span for you. So for you to find a smaller version of Deloitte, a regional consulting firm or an industry boutique special firm that focuses on life sciences or your particular use case, that works very well. And then your aim was then to grow to a one of the big five down the road, big four, whatever, however many there are these days. And that's something we had to learn along the way, which I think took trial and error, but we finally, I think, cracked the code on that.
So do you offer your own consulting too, or is it pure play SaaS?
Pure play SaaS and on-premise SaaS. So when we talk about SaaS, that's our revenue model. It's all subscription-based, but we offer it cloud and self-hosted, and that's because of the industries we serve. So the revenue is still 100% recurring, flat, but we offer it on both deployment models. So when you hear SaaS, I often think, is it the business model SaaS or is it the technical architecture SaaS? And you can do both. But we do no consulting, I would say almost no, just some limited training. And even that we do mostly online. So that, because the problem then is if you start to do a lot of consulting, there are two downfalls. One is you start to make your product designed only so your consulting team can use it. So it stops being a general purpose self-service product. It becomes too hard to use. And the second thing is you're going to cannibalize your channel partner revenue. If I'm a consulting firm and you're consulting as well, why do I want to partner with you? So I think it's really important to understand what business you're in. It's okay to be a consulting firm that has in-house tools. We have quite a few partners that do that. And then when they try and productize that in-house tool, they always find it much, much harder to monetize that tool than they thought. So that's one thing I would say is if you're going to start off as a product firm, be a product firm. If you're going to be a service firm, be a service firm and have tools to accelerate your services. Don't confuse that with being a pure play SaaS firm. I've seen so many companies take a product that worked internally and try and use it very, very hard because the product market fit was internal. It was never necessarily validated externally.
For sure, yeah. It's important to understand who you are, who your partners are, who you can partner with to help you scale your business. So on that note, Gawan, what would you say is your biggest challenge that you're facing in the business today?
Well, I think like anyone, it's probably growing in revenue and top line. Top line is always the key problem. Brand building when you're a smaller company. For those who may not have known, we have not raised any money. So we're still internally self-funded, bootstrapped, whatever the term du jour is. And that means you don't have the resources to compete with which we do compete with, like an IBM or Atlassian or Microsoft. So you have to be much more, targeted in your marketing. You've got to be very, very focused in where you're spending. So the challenge, I think, for us has always been brand building and then obviously the lead gen side. One thing we found interesting on the channel side that has been a challenge, particularly recently, is because of COVID, a lot of our consulting partners have moved from project work to staff augmentation work. And that was a secular trend over the last 3 years during the COVID and post-COVID. And I think because of that, they're not doing projects as much. They have less direction on the tool, so they can't recommend to clients. So we found that a lot of our consulting partners have less power in the market to be able to recommend products. They're more driven by the clients. And so what we've done to sort of mitigate that trend has been to start to build more of an ecosystem, which is not just service partners, but also technology partners who have complementary solutions. And when you put those together, the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts. I would say that's been one of the challenges, is trying to make sure we can find the right kind of work for a consulting partner that is not just implementing our product, but implementing it with our product and including other integrations that may be useful for the client. And that gives the client a stronger value proposition to use our partner. It gets our partner more of a value proposition to work with us and also our other technology partners to work with us. So I think that's one of the challenges has been how to craft this ecosystem. It's been much more challenging than I thought it was a year ago. We thought a service technology partner could be split very neatly, and it really hasn't worked out that way.
So in terms of scaling, it's like, what is a typical sales cycle look like for you? Like, how long is it?
I guess that's the other challenge. It's really lengthened. It used to be, say, 3 months. So a typical sales cycle would be inbound lead comes to us. They might sign up for a trial. They might want to talk to us first. Either way, there's going to be a trial where they will sign up for a trial, typically 30 days of the product. We'll do a discovery call. Now, some clients are fully self-service. They don't really talk to us much. They just try it and buy it, especially if they're a referral or have used it before. Otherwise, we'll do a discovery call about 30 minutes, and then we'll do 1 to 2 1-hour web, online Zoom demos. And that's typically the initial engagement. And then traditionally, that would take about 60 days, 30 days to go through legal compliance and purchasing. And then, 3 months later, they would buy an initial license. And then we would engage customer success expansion teams to work with them to expand the deal. What we've seen is that 3 months has now become 6 months. And that last 3 months is not the client. It's not the person we've spoken to. It's the legal team, the GDPR, the privacy team, security team. That is taking 3 months longer than it did 2 years ago. And it's just very frustrating. So I think I would say having somehow in-house, and for a lot of small companies, that means you have to have some kind of in-house legal resources because they're going to redline all your agreements. They're not going to take your SaaS agreement, especially because we're dealing with medium to large companies. They have whole teams dedicated to purchasing, and that slows everything down. So I think that's been the big change in the deal structure. But the 30-day, the 3 month upfront is still largely similar. Within 3 months, we get a client saying, yes, I want to buy, but it now becomes 3 more months of compliance and legal before it actually gets a signed purchase order. And also, I think we're seeing the reduction of shadow IT. So if you think about shadow IT, is that, our team, we want to buy a tool, let's get a credit card, let's buy a 20-user team license of this thing, and your other team's going to buy another 20-user license. And particularly during the early years of COVID, people wanted their teams to be productive at all costs, and everyone was moving to the cloud. A lot of the existing tools didn't work. So everyone had the authority to go buy whatever they needed to make it work, and we'll figure it out later. Well, now is later. So IT departments are now clawing back that authority and like, no, you don't get to use a credit card anymore. You have to go through purchasing. We're going to look at all the teams are doing, and we're going to rationalize and choose one or two products, not 10. And that, again, complicates the sales cycle, slows things down, ... and makes it much more challenging.
So I guess, how do you position yourself as not just a commodity? Because it's something that obviously, as you said, right, people need what you're offering. So I think that I'm sure it can be a challenge for you saying, hey, listen, you have all these different tools, but it's like if they don't have your tool, especially in these highly regulated industries, they can really be in a bad situation.
That's why that's a great observation. And I think that is why we decided to differentiate by industry. Because for a longer time, we're a testing tool, we're a project management tool, we're one of maybe 30, 40, 50 60, 70 different products. We have some feature differentiation. Feature differentiation or price differentiation is a commodity market. What we decided was, well, that's okay. We still have some of that business, but let's focus on certain key verticals. So we started actually initially with healthcare. That was our very first one. We looked at healthcare. We looked at what it needed to do software type systems and hardware systems, even in the medical device and pharmaceutical industries. We looked at the regulations. And the regulations, which are a roadblock, became a competitive advantage. We built white papers, we did videos, we added features to the tool that are specific to healthcare clients. For those who are interested, electronic signatures, FDA compliance, EMEA compliance, there's things you have to have that if you have, your tool can sail through the audit process and is a key differentiator. It's not a feature, it's actually a capability difference. And that's an important differentiation, is it's not just simply adding a feature that someone says, I need that feature. It's like, I have to have that feature. That's the difference. Right. And then we cracked that first with healthcare. And then we said, well, let's look at defense and aerospace because they have some similar needs and some different needs. We added some additional unique features for defense and aerospace. And then from there, we're now looking at automotive. We're doing white papers and starting to look at some of the automotive standards and seeing what's unique that's different. And there's maybe 10 to 20% difference that we need to think about different features for. So it's like taking different niches and then making features that are, and really use cases that are separate for those. And then another use case that we identified was quite a few of our larger competitors are moving from cloud and on-premise to only cloud. And so as a result, for example, the big news, Atlassian's doing this. So we've had a lot of interest from former Atlassian customers that often used our tools with Jira. And now we're like, well, your tool can do some of what Jira does. So we actually invested in adding some features to close the gap, specifically for clients that need to be on-premise or off the internet, you know, for example, national security, Swiss banks, a lot of European banks actually, and insurance companies, they need to be off the internet, or they want to be in a private cloud where they control the encryption keys. They want to have it in their own Azure instance. They don't want to be in a public SaaS environment. And that's a much harder use case. It's not in the sense that if you can't meet that use case, it's not a, we can almost meet it. No, you either have it or you don't. And it's a much crisper need than say, I like this feature, I like that feature, or this price and that price. So we've had clients that have told us, you know, we have to migrate by February next year. That's a hard date because at that point, that product stops, you know, being available on our infrastructure. So if you find examples of hard migration and hard switch points, the soft switch point is, oh, this product's too expensive, it's too hard to use, the team doesn't like it. Well, if they discount the price, the client will like it more. So whenever you're competing with people and talking to them and finding out why they want to move to your product, there's what I would call hard switching points and soft switching points. The soft ones can be mitigated by the incumbent, by reducing the price, adding a feature, improving customer success. And then you may go to all this work to go after that client. And in the end, they're just using you as a means to get the current provider to reduce their price, to improve quality or something. And you're just simply there as a differentiation, as a comparison point. If it's a hard switching point, that client has to make a decision. They've got to migrate by this date, or they've got to meet this new regulation. They have to have this new tool. We had some clients who were using spreadsheets and they were failing their audits. So they had to move by the time they had their next audit. And as a salesperson or in the sales organization, we'll track, when do they have to migrate by? And then let's work back. You know, it's a 6-month sales cycle. We need to make sure we've done a demo by this date. We've got a PO, you know, proof of concept by this date, et cetera, et cetera. Purchasing takes 3 months. So you can use these milestones that the client has to adopt something and then work back the sales cycle. So I would say that's a really important thing to avoid being a commodity is industry and then specific use cases, whether that's a horizontal use case, like in this case, it's the architecture, or it could be a vertical use case like an industry.
Makes sense. So obviously, like you mentioned, for 2024, your goal, like any company's increase in revenue, right? So what are you looking to get to approximately, just compared to where you're at now?
Right. So we're just about around 10 million ARR at the current state. And the plan is to increase that. Our typical goal is 35% year over year. That's what we'd like to grow year over year, 35%. And I think one of the challenges is from a direct sales, that is the inbound direct and a little bit of outbound, which we do. That's a hard number to grow every year, especially as you get bigger. It's bigger every year because you're 35% of a much larger number. And so that's why we put a lot of resources into our channel program. We have two people dedicated just to partnerships. And we traditionally, I think, I focus a lot on partnerships in Europe and North America. We've just hired someone in Australia to be our partner and sales, like a regional manager in Australia. And we're hoping that she's going to be able to really grow our partnership ecosystem there, which has been weaker. And actually, that's a very important market for that, because whereas in Europe and North America, a US company can often just deliver remotely. Once you go into East Asia and South America, those markets tend to require a local presence and often a local partner. You're dealing with things like, you know, currency movements, particularly South America, currency movements, political movements can be very difficult. So you have to have local partners that can navigate your clients through that. And in East Asia, you need to have, you know, if you're going to sell into South Korea, you need a company that's going to focus on, you know, manufacturing and telecommunications companies in South Korea, and it's going to be a local partner for you. Same thing in Japan. Philippines is and Vietnam are a bit more open. But in most of these, you need to have partners. So whereas in Europe and North America, you can sell direct inbound and outbound. I think channel sales is a nice to have. In East Asia and South America, channel sales is a must have because you won't be able to close the business at all.
So in terms of these partners, or if you have partners in some of these countries, like obviously there's probably some level of a language barrier. So like having that partner, is there that challenge sometimes too, where somebody has to like go and translate the conversation, or do you not deal with that?
Oh, well, great question. Yeah, we have our own people in those countries. So yeah, if you're going to focus on Latin America, you, for example, just to pick as simple, because there's only two languages, pretty much Portuguese and Spanish. There's some little bit of French here and there and English here and there too, but let's say Spanish and Portuguese. So if you're going to tackle the LATAM market, you will need partners in almost all those countries. You will also need to hire someone that's your own full-time person, which we do have, who can speak Spanish and Portuguese, who is resident in there. So you don't necessarily need to have 10 people, one in each country. We get by, I think, with one person in Argentina, and he covers the region for us, but you're not going to sign up partners without a person that's your person. We've tried that as well. We tried before doing partnerships from remote from the US, where that works again in North America. Most of Europe, you can get by. Maybe probably not France. France, you'd have a French-speaking person on your team. Middle East, where we've got an Arabic speaker, same thing. That's really helped us open doors in Saudi and UAE. So I think you need to have at least a core, like in our case, Inflectra person in these regions. And then from there, you can then build a hub of partners who can cover all the different countries. So I think a lot of people get discouraged. They're like, well, I can't afford 10 people in South America, which is a lowish purchasing power region. No, you don't need that. You can have one person, and then you can have partnerships to fill the gap. But you can't have no people. No partner's going to take you seriously. You're not going to get any image out of that person if you do that.
Makes sense. So what would you say is the one biggest piece of advice that you wish you knew before you started this company?
Oh, there's so many. I would say, I think, well, specifically for me, we started as, and for anyone who's not raising money, we started as a lifestyle company for many years. And that was, we had a good product. We did it online. It was growing. And then I got more serious in about 2015. That's why we've been around for so long, because it's almost like two phases. What I didn't fully appreciate was the power of time, is that, we had a really good idea in 2006, and we went big in 2007 or 8. And then, you know, I would say we didn't have the external mantra of someone saying, you got to grow at this percent, grow at that percent. And so we were growing more at 10 to 15% during that lifestyle phase, which is fine. We were profitable. We were doing fine. But you start to seed market share. And one of the things I think I didn't realize as a product company is, if you're a consulting firm, you can stay a 20-person boutique consulting firm for the rest of your life. You can make good money, and you can have a business that's sustainable for 30 to 40 years. I would say it's possible. In the software product space, it's very, very hard. You have to either be growing or you're going to be replaced. And that, I think I hadn't fully appreciated that. And I think if I was doing it all over again, I would have started the growth journey faster. I mean, I don't know. My life at that point, I had very young children. Maybe it wasn't the right phase for me, but I think right. It still is a regret. The regret was we didn't double down faster. Maybe that's true for everyone. And without an external investor who's going to give you that discipline and pretty much force you to do it, it's easy not to do that. It's easy to say, we're profitable. We've got a good product. Customers like us. You live in your own echo chamber of your existing customer base, who will tell you how great you are all the time. And you go out into the wider world and you start talking to non-customers who use other tools. They're like, we've never heard of you. Why would we use this product? Oh, it's like there's 10 other products like this that I have heard of. And you're like, oh man, I thought we were doing well. So I think the world is much bigger than you think. And I think if you don't focus, you have to really think about, how am I going to grow to that next step all the time? And I think at times we cruise about on autocomplete in the early days. And I would say that's the biggest macro thing I regret.
Makes sense. So if somebody watching this wanted to reach out to you, do you mind sharing your company website or social media handles? Just best way to get in contact with you?
Oh, absolutely. Inflectra.com on the web is the website, and the sign is behind me. Personally, LinkedIn, Adam Sandman on LinkedIn, and also adam.sandman@inflectra.com is my email address. All of those are good mechanisms. I must admit, I used to be more active on the Twitter, X, formerly known as Twitter. I don't use it that much anymore. So LinkedIn, email, website, probably the most popular places. And if you're ever in the DC area and interested to talk about starting companies, founding companies, you know, always happy to chat as well.
Sounds great. Well, Adam, we're rooting for you, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks so much.
Thanks. All right. Bye.